Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, joining us in the studio, we are welcoming documentary filmmaker Steve Mims, whose latest movie, Starving the Beast, details an ongoing crisis in public higher education. After decades of funding cuts, our great public universities are finding themselves increasingly vulnerable to the whims of agenda-setting politicians and post-crash disruptors who are angling to redefine these universities' missions and curricula, leaving them as shadows of their former selves. The movie is coming soon to a theater near you. Hopefully, it gets there before the emergency it describes. Meanwhile, are capitalism and democracy headed for some kind of nasty breakup? And will they stay together for the kids? That's the provocative contention of influential British economist Martin Wolf, who recently took to the pages of The Economist to suggest that the pace of globalization may be pushing us to make a choice. Given the state of our politics, where cash rules everything around us, it could be that this choice is already being made for us. Finally, they say that any time our national anthem is sung, we have the opportunity to pause and contemplate this nation of ours and our place within it. Oddly enough, San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick recently took this opportunity for himself to think deeply about these matters, and he's getting pilloried in the press for having done so. I guess ruminating on America is all well and good until you point out the racism. We'll discuss the story that has every hot take artist with a sub 100 IQ all afroth this week. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Paul Blumenthal, Zach Carter, Elise Foley, and Travis Waldron. We'll have all of that, plus all the latest ways that Donald Trump has flipped and flopped incoherently on his immigration policy. But here's what happened first. Hello, America. Welcome back to another edition of So That Happened, your weekly podcast about everything that's gone wrong in the country and what we're trying to do to fix it as best we can. I'm Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post. Joining me right now, right off the bat, is our friend Arthur Delaney. Arthur Delaney is having a baby, right?
His wife had a baby now.
His wife had a baby.
He's helping her take care of it.
He's helping take care of it. We miss him. He's
but
not
Zach
here.
I'm Zach Carter, and I'm on the podcast
Zach Carter
every
is
week.
Here. I don't know why I said Arthur Delaney.
Apologies to all the Arthur fans who have to settle for me every segment this week.
But feel good. He's having a kid, and his last kid was pretty cool. I have high hopes for this kid. Really, I do. And Brett is a very special guest joining us today. He is a documentary filmmaker best known for the movie Incendiary, which discussed at great length the death penalty case of Cameron Todd Willingham and Rick Perry's involvement in sending an innocent man to jail and to death row and to his death. His new movie is called Starving the Beast. It is about higher education and everything that's going wrong in higher education. Welcome, please, Steve Mims.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Steve, tell me about why you wanted to do this movie.
Well, I live in Austin, Texas, and basically came from reading the newspaper. We were following what was happening in Texas, and to make a long story short, the governor, Rick Perry, was appointing people to the Board of Regents for Texas A&M and to UT Austin. And evidently, in what we later found out to be true, he was appointing them to radically change them from the inside out. So there he had literally an agenda to go in and modify the way that those universities handled research, the way they handled tenure, the way they handled all the important things that make a university a university. And so he had put people in place to help facilitate that. And it what made it worthy of being in the newspaper was, like, you know, nobody ever reads anything interesting about boards of regents. Usually wealthy, older guys who meet, you know, and say yes, no, yes, no. And in this case, it's like people are having a fit. And so we knew that there was a story there, and so we started covering that initially. And then in our research, and then the people that we came across and we talked to, people basically shared with us that this is not unique to Texas, that this story and stories with the similar cast of characters and influences was basically happening all over the country. And so we started broadening out the film to cover what was happening at UVA and what was happening at the University of Wisconsin and Chapel Hill and LSU. And I'm leaving out some school, but the...
Wisconsin and Madison.
Yeah. And so, that's how we got involved.
So the story around the University of Virginia is very dear to both my heart and Jason's because mm-hmm. we're both alumni of the University of Virginia, or alumnuses.
Alumni is the plural.
Alumnu.
Alumni.
Alumni. and as a result of being alumnuses, we followed the controversy surrounding Teresa Sullivan a couple years ago very, very closely. And yeah. one of the things that really jumped out at me from that whole mess was the degree to which the university, despite having all of this sort of political influence from, you know, the state university, only takes a tiny shred of its funding mm-hmm. from the state. Right. How does that end up playing out in sort of the politics of higher education?
It's a problem, and it's a uniquely public university problem. Like, this is an important distinction. This is the issues we cover in the film are peculiar to public universities, and it's because they take X amount of funding from the state. And for the privilege of taking a tiny percentage, they're under the dominion of politicians because these are people, the Board of Regents have been appointed by governors or whoever they're appointed by in different states. And they're beholden to the state legislature. So, for instance, at UT Austin, they, in around 1980, they got about 60% of their money from the state. Now they get 12%. But for that 12%, they have to do anything that the state tells them to do, including allowing people to carry guns on campus because they're a state entity, even though they have to find the other giant check of money to fund the place.
So you end up with sort of the worst of both worlds in the ownership equation, where you still have to go out and court private donors,
right?
But at the same time, your minority stakeholder, for instance, has effectively limitless power over you.
Yes,
and you're putting more of the cost on the students through higher tuition,
right? I mean,
engenders the need to like, well, is this degree like working out in a neoliberal equation of, I mean, like a job at the end that made the debt worth it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that you hear about over and over now about public higher education or about higher education is about student debt. Mm-hmm. And there's a whiff of in all that reporting that basically wants to indict the students for borrowing money for what people think is they're wasting their time, spending a lot of time getting a degree, and maybe it's frivolous what they're studying.
Like my English degree and Zach's philosophy degree.
Yeah, obviously useless.
Yeah.
And so, however, what that focus misses is the 35-year history before that. Like the reason why all that debt, well, one reason why all that debt's piled up is because the burden for paying for the university has shifted from a small percentage to the majority. And so that money has to come from somewhere. The universities, UVA, UT, they've all been very entrepreneurial about dealing with this. I mean, they're never not fundraising. Like, yeah. They're always asking for money. They have done everything. They've outsourced people. Like, they'll have a lot of universities, all their accounting is done by somebody who subcontracts for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have adjunct faculty people. You know, they've done everything they can to remain competitive. And it's still expensive. And so now, you know, you can walk out of a place like University of Wisconsin-Madison with a degree that's competitive with, you know, Stanford or MIT, depending on where you're in. And you're going to walk out with a debt that's not unlike what you would have from Stanford or MIT. When the whole idea initially was the state is going to underwrite these universities because it's a wise investment in people, and those people are going to make the state stronger and financially viable, and they're going to make the world better. And that has been the case. Like, that's one part about the argument that is pretty irrefutable. Like, the wisdom from before the Morrill Act, you know, all the way back to Jefferson, that that's going to build a great country. And actually, you're going to wind up with a public education system that's so valuable that people will pay a premium to ship their kids from wherever in the world and pay the highest rate for tuition because it has a value, right?
That's one of the more interesting things about the movie is you do a good job sort of like talking about this convergence of conservative politicians who want to limit the sort of like kind of curriculum that produces critical thinkers. And you also have sort of meritocrats who want to do like they did at UVA, strategic dynamism, right size, run things as a business. Right. One of the things that has interested me about this is that we do have for-profit institutions where they are run as a business, where they commodify education, they treat students as customers, not as people being educated. They're not treated as a public good. And those institutions have failed. They failed to educate their students properly, position them in the marketplace, not saddle them with debt.
Right.
It seems to me that all these forces understand that they can't actually create a bespoke for-profit brand that has the same sort of legacy impact as a University of North Carolina, University of Virginia, University of Michigan, University of Texas, that those brands still have prestige, but they do seem very bent on limiting the things that made those brands so prestigious. One of my favorite characters in your book is Jeff Sandifer. This is a guy who wrote like a memorandum, his seven steps to basically running the entire UT system as a business. In one breath, he talks about how his idea is so important, everyone has to adopt it, and he'll throw a snit fit and start his own school if no one will adopt it. Out of the other breath, he's like, you know, I think study Shakespeare, William Faulkner, I'm not so sure he's as important to study. I'm just like, so this guy literally places himself at a higher position prestige-wise and learning-wise than arguably the greatest American fiction writer.
Right.
Which is nuts to me.
Yeah. No, it's really – we tried to put that in the film. And there are other people who speak in the film. And I have to say they have conviction, right? They're saying what they believe.
They do.
But that conviction is – kind of amazing, and that's one of the values of seeing the film. It's like these people mean it. They I think that they really believe it. But people need to know they're out there. People are out there who think and believe that.
So I swim in these swamps of most of my reporting is surrounding financial policy, economic policy, and I really dislike the frame by which we analyze education for its like economic output. I think it's just it's good and it's okay for it to be good, whether it like results in a balance sheet getting bigger or smaller. But it has been interesting to me to talk to a lot of community bankers who are typically they get this sort of like good guy reputation in Washington because they're not like the Wall Street guys, but they're generally just kind of like conservative white male Republicans, and they've started talking about student debt. And they talk about it because they're realizing that they're not selling, you know, community bankers do pretty boring stuff, right? They're not selling as many car loans. They're not selling as many mortgages to people who are 22, 23, 25, because these kids are coming out of college with all this debt. And it's interesting to me to see this become, you know, sort of a problem for businesses. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the balance sheet of like the state, of what it costs to do something, I think we often forget that like if the state's not shouldering this burden, if we as you know, citizens aren't shouldering that as taxpayers, it ends up coming out somewhere, right? And it's coming out of the economy in this way. I'm curious about the students is there a perception among students in the schools that you were covering, like, do they see public funding as an issue, or do they see that as being divorced from the debt problem?
You know, I honestly, I really can't say. Although I can say that I think students are probably the least informed about this because they're in school. They're there, and that's part of the insidious nature of this problem. And that is, these universities are essentially repopulated every 4 years or so. And so if you go to UVA today, you don't know what it was like 4 years ago. You don't know what it was like 16 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true for alumni. They go back and they go like, oh, the place looks great.
And nothing's on fire.
Yeah.
There's something new. That's good. Growth is good. Right.
But the underpinnings of it can all be gone, and they would be the last people to know and not really want to know. And this is another problem is that universities themselves are loath to wade into this. because they're an ongoing concern. Like they are worried about this semester. They're worried about their incoming people next year. And their response to this has been largely positive. Like they're always saying the good things they're doing, and that's what they should be doing. But they are public employees, and they're circumspect about saying, oh, by the way, the place is on fire. That we got to fix it, but send your kids here anyway. They can't simultaneously present those two worldviews.
Right. When LSU said they were going to go into bankruptcy, that was the earth-shaking event that changed everything. And right. As you make the point of the movie, probably the earth-shaking event was that a year without LSU football.
LSU football, you cannot not have that, you know. So, yeah, this is a – these they're state employees that are, you know, are, even if they have tenure, can be fired. They're maybe, I think, maybe overly cautious about dealing with this issue because they have to make sure that the university continues to function. So that makes it hard. And so they're not sharing this with students. And students are not really, I mean, think about what you're like when you're an undergrad. It's like you're there to do whatever you're there to do. And it's like, so I don't think it's a...
We'll not talk about our undergraduate days here.
I think even in terms of debt, like the way people look at debt, I think, especially from the middle class in these schools, is that student debt is still the best debt, right? So if it's a given that you're going to have debt, I think the philosophy of a lot of families is we're going to find a way to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. The issue of like how much it's going to be or whatever, we're going to deal with that at the end, but...
You got to get the education.
You have this one, though. You're gonna get in there, and you're going to do it because you can't be walking around in the United States without the right paperwork now to potentially get the job that you're going to need because you don't know what it's going to be. So I think people are willing to be aware of it but live through it and then deal with the outcome later. And I think that's part of, like, why this has become such an insidious thing.
All right. Well— Starving the Beast is opening in Washington, D.C. tomorrow, Friday, at the East Street Cinema in Washington. It then will begin to open up across the country. It's at the IFC Center in New York City on the 9th of September. It's going to be opening in Austin, Charlottesville, Los Angeles, and Madison on the 16th of September. And it's going to be going mostly to some of the places where you actually did this research. And so students who maybe have been at a distance from this, and understandably so because they're all working for their betterment as well, will have an opportunity to start to engage these issues or drunk. They're going to have an opportunity to like really understand the pressures that are being placed on your schools behind the scenes. So I recommend this movie to everybody. Please check it out. Starvingthebeast.com, I believe. Starvingthebeast.net. Check out the preview. Read the materials and get to a showing if you can.
Yeah. No.
All right. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again, for
coming by and agreeing to an interview with me for whatever.
I'm a giant fan actually. So,
well, thanks. We really appreciate that.
All right.
Yes. Steve Mim says,
"No,
this podcast is the one to listen to among many."
Absolutely.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everybody, we're back. So from time to time, we like to check in with the most recent thought-fluencing from the meritocracy and how they want to govern our lives in a more efficient manner, allocate capital correctly, turn the shock troops in the global war on capital out in greater numbers. And here to talk about that is Zach Carter.
Why, hello.
And Paul Blumenthal.
Hello.
Making, I think, no, not your debut on this podcast.
Second time, yes.
Paul, been a while. Paul is our money in politics man. And we're going to talk about some money in politics, man. So, Zach, set up the story of that this Martin Wolf column that is going to be a game changer for all of us.
So this was a pretty big deal, I think. Martin Wolf is he's probably the most widely read and influential British economics writer. He writes for the Financial Times. And he's a guy who's been very much sort of part of the global mainstream for a good 20 or so years. He wrote a book in 2004 called Why Globalization Works, right? So he's not somebody who you would have seen like in 1999 protesting the WTO in Seattle.
Okay, fair enough.
He's deeply embedded in the global elite and is really influential among them. But he wrote a column basically saying that democracy and capitalism may be headed for a divorce here. The idea of, like, you know, a free market where people are free to make their decisions, and the idea of, like, a democracy where you're free to vote for who you want and say stuff without being oppressed, those seem like they're sort of harmonious ideas. But what we're actually seeing as global capitalism advances or just does what it's done for the last 30 years is a rise of unaccountable global economic forces that seem to be operating against the wishes of people who actually vote for political norms and governances. And he suggested that this is causing sort of a crack up in global politics.
So my response to that would be like, fine, let's definitely save democracy and rethink capitalism. Cool, we're done, right? We're good to go, right?
Well, I think Martin Wolf is a little less ready to just like throw out capitalism. He was suggesting we could maybe start by throwing out free trade agreements, or at least rethinking the way we do them. You know, if you look at TPP or NAFTA or the WTO agreements, they do give corporations this ability, unique ability, to challenge, you know, government regulations and laws before an international body. And they're, you know, particularly like NAFTA and TPP, these are privileges that they don't afford to like labor unions. If a country violates, you know, labor law, or environmental groups, if a country dumps a bunch of, you know, shit in a river, this is clearly an attempt to give corporations greater influence over the political process.
In fact, they're more apt to overturn a law that would criminalize or penalize someone for polluting that river than they would be to actually protect that river.
There's a whole industry actually that's picking up of people. Dave Dame reported on this for us earlier this week. There's an industry of people who just are buying up companies based on their ability to speculatively file lawsuits against sovereign governments over environmental regulations or labor regulations that they expect to come down the pike. So there are real problems with this stuff, and he wants to rethink that. But I do think it's important to think, you know, just because capitalism looks the way it does now doesn't mean that it has to look that way in all times. And I feel like, Paul, you know, you've written a lot about corruption and money and politics for us. I feel like we're living in sort of like a uniquely corrupt moment right now, that it hasn't always been this bad. Am I wrong about that?
I mean, I think it really depends on how you look at it. Historically, you go back, I mean, you have like C. Wright Mills writing about like domination of politics by, you know, like a global corporate elite or even just a local corporate elite back in the 1950s. So, I mean, it's not like people haven't worried about this for a long time. But certainly, I mean, you just look at the direction of politics in a lot of countries in Europe and even in the United States, and you see people sort of reacting to this divergence between, you know, who's really doing the winning, if I'm going to, you know, paraphrase Donald Trump. And mm-hmm. It's, you know, giant global multinational corporations that have been winning basically since the 1970s, since they sort of divorced from any kind of national social contract and involvement. And I think that has gone hand in hand with, you know, spikes in corporate influence in political economies across the world, campaign contributions, lobbying, and, you know, a rise in inequality that comes with political decisions made by our leaders influenced by corporations.
That's also around the same time frame where we see the divergence in between wages and capital as well, the sort of like 40-year
pretty much starts
gap.
In the 1970s. And then I think, you know, this debate we're having, or Martin Wolf is bringing up and that you wrote about, Zach, you know, about the divergence between democracy and capitalism sort of goes back to the fall of the USSR and, you know, the quote-unquote mm-hmm. end of history, according to Fukuyama.
Yeah, Francis Fukuyama.
You know, and it turned out that, you know, history didn't end, but now that, you know, what remained was liberal democracy and capitalism as, like, the two pillars of what could be the end of history, and now they are at heads.
Yeah, I think, you know, at the end of the First World War, and then again at the end of the Second World War, there were very serious problems for capitalism and democracy. And people like John Maynard Keynes made eloquent pleas to please reform capitalism so that it works. And they didn't after World War I, but then they did after World War II.
There was a whole thing that happened there.
Yeah, there are people, including Keynes, who believe that World War II happened because they didn't fix capitalism after World War I. But the big scare at that time was that you were going to see communism or you're going to see fascism. And Wolf talks in his article about sort of a different threat. He talks about, you know, confiscatory, autocratic regimes, maybe run by dictators. It's really a nice word for fascism, or a nice turn of phrase for fascism.
Sure.
On the one hand, and he talks about regimes like Putin's Russia, like Erdogan's Turkey, that seem to be moving in that direction. And then he also talks about, but instead of talking about socialism, he talks about something else. He talks about the rise of this sort of global plutocrat class. And I felt like for the 2016 race, I think a lot of Democrats find it very easy to say, okay, well, Donald Trump clearly represents one of those, right? He's running a fascist campaign. That's clearly he's the fascist responding to this sort of economic crisis. But I think Democrats are more reluctant to see Hillary Clinton as representative of the global super elite. But I thought of that immediately. What do you guys think about that?
I think that's correct. I mean, one of the things we keep coming back to on the show is that Clinton's vision for solving the problem of economic inequality. She sees it all through this rubric of, well, we need greater diversity in the professional class. Like, those who are affluent, they're too white and too male. And a virtuous society would have a less white and less male dominated affluent class. But there's nothing in her rhetoric that suggests that she has any type of plan for the middle class or the working class.
She would diversify the existing inequality, racially and gender, which would be better than what we have now, right? That would be progress.
I mean,
but it would still you still have a dominant economic class.
It's definitely virtuous to diversify the creative class and the professional class. There's no doubt about that. But I mean, really, there's been a rich diversity among the poor for quite some time. Like the fact that the poor have achieved an equilibrium of diversity, it doesn't attract any attention. It doesn't make anyone want to come and solve their problems. It seems to me like there's, you know, the road to serfdom is leading a way that the person who originally wrote that book didn't expect.
I think there are some policies that Clinton has supported here that I think would make things better. You know, a higher minimum wage. She's, at least for now, opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, I think you could say that there are some policies that she's at least giving lip service to that I think would be good. But when you look at the way the Democratic establishment is talking about
sure.
her candidacy,
yeah.
I mean, Paul, I'd really like to hear from you on this. Like, you know, a lot of the stuff they say about, like, you remember, like, the Goldman Sachs donations and the Clinton Foundation's operations, which, you mean, talk about globalists, like, right?
These sure,
the
yeah.
countries, political rulers from all over the world who give to that. A lot of the defenses to me sound like, it's not corruption if we can't prove, like, a specific quid pro quo of, you know, cash for policy decision making.
Right.
Does that sound to you like Citizens United?
I mean, I think somewhat. I think there are probably differences between, I mean, I think that, you know, the Goldman Sachs speeches are particularly stand out as something that, you know, should get more attention on that front because it's like direct money going into your pocket. It's, you know, income.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, we have ethics restrictions, legal restrictions about where your income can come from if you're actually sitting in office. So, you know, there are similar conceptions about from campaign finance as being like something that fuels your career. You cannot get elected without that money. And therefore, we believe that there should be these certain rules and restrictions and, you know, boundaries around it. You know, we have these conceptions about what it means for a democracy to be electing people with all this money.
Mm-hmm.
I think we similarly do with the kind of income that people are getting. So, yeah, I mean, they're definitely like it sounds sort of like Democrats are accepting somewhat of the Citizens United argument. At the same time, I mean, it's just sort of just pure partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
you know, if this was the Bush administration and they were doing the same things, Democrats would be up in arms and Republicans would be defending it.
Yeah.
And we see that flip around every time. And then I guess to the, you know, the other question about whether Clinton represents this global plutocratic class, you know, I think that it can be definitely true that, you know, a Clinton administration might be more liberal on domestic policy than an Obama administration just simply by the fact that, you know, Obama has pulled the politics further left of center
than they were
over 8 years. And, you know, just the demographics of the party and the fact that there's, you know, this rising group of people and the Bernie Sanders voters who are pulling the party to the left that she'll have to answer to. And at the same time, it can also just look like a corporate diversity program for like Goldman Sachs or Microsoft or whatever. You know, those both can be true at the same time. And, you know, I also think that, you know, Lee Drutman, who's a New America scholar, mm-hmm. who had a piece in Vox the other day talking about how, you know, the dividing line of politics now has shifted between, you know, in 1960s, it was probably a dividing line of class.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays it's one of race and ethnicity and diversity.
Identity.
And identity, yeah. And one of the reasons why is because it's a very politically advantageous line for the Democratic Party to be fighting on.
True.
You know, it really makes Republicans look terrible and unpopular with a lot of voting blocks, including, you know, like suburban and upper class Republicans.
And it allows the Democratic Party to sweep the less savory parts of its sort of coalition under the rug. And yeah, we do paid speeches for Goldman Sachs.
Well, what it helps them do is it helps them win elections. You know, that's what parties are supposed to do.
Presidential elections, anyway.
At least, yeah. Maybe not all the other races.
Yeah, the other one seems like, I feel like there's a sort of a tidal force in the media as well, especially the political media, that sort of like really sort of pulls in this sort of professional class bias. I think that there's lots of people in the media who are willing to talk about how the two-party system seems wrong. But anytime they get around to thinking about what do I want as a third party, they always say, well, you know, the ideal third party would be like not racist and would like service tech billionaires a lot better. And it's just like, no, that's like the most overserved people already.
Well, that's just who the media hangs out with.
Yeah,
so that's what they think. You know, the ideal third party, you know, that would actually succeed is Donald Trump.
Right. We need a racist nationalist party and we need an authentic left party.
That supports Social Security and Medicare.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I think what we're going to see, though, is increasingly the Trumpification of the sort of local and state governments, that they are going to become more kind of Trump-like because the Republicans have a much stronger hold over state governments and local governments than Democrats do. And at the federal level, you'll have Democrats who then are sort of more catering to a professional a multicultural professional class, and that I think is potentially a recipe for a lot of national disharmony. That at the local level you'll have a lot of very powerful Trumpian politics. At the national level, you'll have two parties that basically don't speak to each other and force people who maybe have overlapping interests
and aren't governing in the same venues.
Yeah,
yeah. That's why I say presidential elections, because the Democrats have largely abandoned a lot of these races and a lot of these governing venues. And it's going to allow. I think the National Republican Party will make an effort to try to expurge the Trumpianness from their Washington area, but out in the states, the popularity will remain, and that tinge is going to come back to bite them again and again and again.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big question. You know, you hear from a lot of the never Trump Republicans, or you know, I've talked to some high level Republicans involved in you know, donations, campaign finance, and they think, oh, this will just blow over. You know, Trump is just it's Trump. It's about the
freak event,
It's a freak event. But I think you can already see that like this isn't going anywhere. This is a new cleavage in American politics that Trump is writing. I mean, you even see, you know, Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas, who's like a potential 2020 presidential candidate, going out there talking about restricting legal immigration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if you put a, you know, more polished face on this, Trump politics, maybe in this day and age when a lot of people feel like democracy isn't working for them and capitalism is running roughshod over them.
Freak event.
It might win.
To call this a freak event would be like Michelangelo spending how many years sculpting David and saying, what the fuck did I just do? The thing you intended, the thing you always intended to do, you did, Republicans. Anyway, thank you for being a part of this discussion, Paul.
Well, thanks always, for having me on.
Always a cheer. And late-stage capitalism. Going to be a fun time for everybody. Zach, thank you. And we'll be right back. And we're back. Zach Carter
again, hi everybody,
is here. And we're joined by Elise Foley.
What's up?
So just
happy to be here.
Yeah, just as, you know, if Elise Foley is on this podcast, then that is probably your cue that Donald Trump has wildly shifted in his position on immigration in the past 24 hours.
Is that true?
Has that happened?
I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't say that. I would say that he's more so stayed the same and that he successfully duped a lot of people last week into thinking that he was changing, but in fact was not and proved that he was not.
That's a better way of putting it. I think what I'm thinking about is not so much policy, but like a radical shift in tone over the course of a Wednesday in which he famously traveled to Mexico in a trip that was either 2 days or a month in the making. There are varying reports on that, to meet with Mexico's president. And there they had a sedate, milquetoast joint statement about immigration. And it seemed like Donald Trump was anesthetized. He kept talking about working within the hemisphere to bolster both the American and Mexican economy. I thought, oh, well, that's good news for all those factories in the maquiladoras zone. They're going to be able to retain their labor practices. And he seemed to actually find new foreigners to remind Mexico that they're bothered by, like Central Americans. And then he comes back to a rally in Phoenix, Arizona, and he's once again the slavering freakazoid that we've all come to know and love.
Yeah, I mean, the tone exactly through the course of yesterday or Wednesday. I apologize, Wednesday.
Podcast is outside of time.
Right. Arthur's not here to police it. Over the course of Wednesday, he just totally changed his tone. And the way he was talking about people when he was in Mexico was much more positive. Then he gets to Phoenix and it's some throwaway lines that, yeah, some undocumented people are fine, but mostly let me talk for a long time about how they are mostly criminals and they're definitely here and will kill you and we have to deport all of the criminals, which there are so many.
In the Christopher era,
we'll all die.
He went from referring to them as beyond reproach to returning to them as a criminal element en masse.
Was this just like a way to like keep him in the headlines for a week where he's like, oh, we're softening. Natch.
That's the part I don't understand. There was literally 2 weeks of feint saying, okay, he's going to soften his immigration stance. The pump had been primed for a softer immigration stance. I think the media had been primed to expect to have to write a story. Well, Donald Trump's flip-flopping on what he said. And there was, of course, nuggets of that way, way back when the famous New York Times interview that we don't know about and hasn't been released that has people who do know about it suggest that everything he said about immigration up to this point was just the opening bid on a grand bargain about immigration, and that even the wall that he's talked about is not necessarily a thing he wants to do. So there was 2 weeks of, oh, a pivot is coming. Ann Coulter's going to be disappointed. V-Dare is going to be disappointed. The alt-right is going to be disappointed. And then no, it didn't happen. There was no feint. So why the juking that never happened?
Well, what I think may have happened, and this is just a theory, is that behind the scenes there was a battle within the Trump world over what was the best thing to do. So there were, you know, reports that Chris Christie was urging him to kind of go this way on immigration. I think there are probably others who look at poll numbers who were telling him to go, and by go this way, I mean soften, for lack of a better word.
Not be
That's
as
not
racist.
Not a good one. Yeah, not be as extreme on immigration. And there were some people urging him, I think, probably to do that. And they lost out to the people like Jeff Sessions. I mean, what he was promising last night was both basically along the lines of what Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, proposes. I think that just they won out that side.
So I've got a question. I mean, you cover immigration for us, obviously. I mean, are there Latino, Latina groups that have been more sympathetic to Trump in the last few weeks that have been maybe interested in coming around that you've spoken with? Are there any organizations?
No. No, not as a whole. I mean, there are some Latino Republicans who in the past have said they are willing to, you know, sort of hold their noses and vote for Trump. Some of them, I believe, are even reconsidering now after the speech last night. I think that a lot of people who were in that camp who really opposed Hillary Clinton, and they're not going to, you know, they just cannot vote for her. They can't let, you know, this happen, her win because of them. So they were willing to vote for Trump, but they were really, really hopeful, I think, that this change was coming, and to see that this change is not coming or certainly isn't here now, I think was really disappointing to those people. So I think maybe it was helping him keep some of the people that he already had. But I didn't see any, you know, Latino, large-scale Latino groups being like, oh, this is great. Maybe we can work with this guy.
All right. Well, I mean, God knows we have a weekend to go. He'll probably be on a bunch of Sunday shows. He'll probably say four new different things about immigration.
Fingers crossed. Keep me employed.
Yes. We would definitely keep you employed if Trump was not a candidate for president, Elise. You understand that, right?
I hope.
Yes, we would. Okay, thank you, Elise Foley, for joining us, and we'll be right back. And we're back. With Zach Carter.
Hey.
Sitting in here. And joining us now is our good friend, Travis Waldron. Travis's presence on that podcast means that we are about to talk about something at the intersection of politics and sports. What could that be? What could that be?
I don't know. Did anything happen?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I
mean, Colin Kaepernick?
Kaepernick.
Kaepernick. That's the one. Yeah.
Yes. We're getting now into that sort of, as most people go to sports know, before any game starts, there's this empty gesture where we sing the national anthem.
So you're just going to go straight there,
all the way in.
Yes, I am. Because when I go to a UVA game, I'm already doing my bit for God and country when I'm rooting against Duke. We can all agree on that.
Yeah, that's true.
I think people tell the lie that we sing the national anthem at sports events to have a moment of contemplation. So Colin Kaepernick had himself a moment of contemplation. And this just goes to show that no one actually wants sports people to have moments of contemplation about America.
To be clear, what Colin Kaepernick did was not stand for the national anthem at a
preseason game.
An important preseason game.
Yeah.
Ruined the Republic by not standing for the national anthem at a preseason game.
But
it was an active protest.
It was intended as such.
Sure. And, you know, I think the funny thing is there's so many facets of this that are, wait, what is the flag? What is the national anthem? And are we actually going to listen to what Colin Kaepernick said, or are we just going to debate whether it was appropriate to say it
at all
in that venue?
Yeah. Yes.
Because, like, everyone comes out, and, you know, you've seen this from Drew Brees and all these other NFL players. I respect what he said, but that was disrespectful in that venue. And it's like, well, what
fucking venue?
When
do you
are
have...
you supposed to protest?
Yeah, exactly.
on your home, at home when you're writing your blog.
Right, like the entire point of a protest.
That's
protest
what the Players Tribune
101
is to
get attention for it.
Yeah, and to make it troublesome for people.
And if you're protesting something that is a nationwide problem, and this is the thing about Colin Kaepernick's stance, is we can all pretty much agree that what he's protesting, we've decided, at least some of us in this country, that this is a problem worth addressing.
And the problem here is police killing black people.
Right.
Right. And if that's something that you see as a systemic ill in this country, what is there a better symbol to protest than the American flag?
seriously, or at a football game, or even to, it's a preseason football game.
And the idea that you can't question the flag.
It's ridiculous.
And I think it goes to your point about this sort of symbolic nature of the national anthem at sporting events, is that it's just become so ritualistic. It's something we just do.
Right.
And there's no real thought to it. There's no real, you know, what are we doing? What does this mean?
In Baltimore, they just wait to say O's when we get to the end of it. That's all they do. That's the whole point of that.
But, you know, I think in football, it's a little bit different, because I think football it seems more like a performance of a militaristic proxy war game. You listen to football coaches, they talk about putting on your helmet and going to war.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It feels more of like a militaristic event, even though, you know, it is not the same as going out and getting shot
at. But it is the proxy. But,
yeah.
And also, I mean, I think there's a different reaction in football
culture
to this
is much different
than it would have been in another sport, because
like
football is such a conservative status quo. There's so much like militaristic ethos to it.
It's and there's not gender tied up in it. You know?
Right. It's not just, you know, that we use the military words in football. It's that they follow kind of military code type stuff. You know, we're all a unit. We're all a team. We're, you know, everybody has their part.
And it's very essentially American. We talk about having a holiday after the Super Bowl.
Right.
You know, just like we would for, you know, a president or Martin Luther King. Let's take Monday off after the Super Bowl, because that's just as important.
But the history of the national anthem, I mean, people talk about who some of the people who complain said, well, maybe I agree with this guy on policy, but I don't like him politicizing the sport. The history of the national anthem at sporting events is inherently political.
The very act of playing the national anthem is political.
We just saw the Olympics, where it was supposed to be the sort of ringing endorsement of our jingoistic pride to hear the national anthem.
And
play.
I think if you look back at the history of this, I mean, Colin Kaepernick is not the first black athlete to raise issue with the national anthem.
Right.
We've seen Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. It was 20 years ago this year that he refused to stand for the national anthem before an NBA game because, you know, he said it was a symbol of tyranny, primarily against Muslims.
What I find interesting is that
they destroyed his career, and then we kind of have gotten worse on the Muslim thing. We look back now.
You know, it's funny that it's happened. A bunch of people have made this point. It's funny that it happened this summer. You know, after this summer when Muhammad Ali died. Mm-hmm. And we had this glorious sort of moment about celebrating Muhammad Ali's activism and his like the idea that Muhammad Ali would stand up to the man and stand up to everyone. And obviously there's still a lot of people who don't like the fact that he didn't go to Vietnam. But we celebrated this man who was larger than his moment.
History has decided that Vietnam was a mistake, and so because he was on the right side of history of that, we have now decided that it was a good thing, even though it basically ruined his career.
But if you look at the in the moment reactions to Ali, the in the moment reactions to John Carlos and Tommy Smith at the 1968 Olympics when they did the Black Power salute, you know, it was the same as what we're going through now. It's, you know, it's simultaneously an idea that a lot of people don't want to believe there are racial problems in this country, and the idea that we don't want our athletes doing this, especially the black athlete.
One of the things I find interesting, though, is that a lot of NBA stars, famous NBA stars, have sort of decided to take on the burden of bringing awareness to the fact that blacks are killed by police. Mm-hmm. And politicizing it every chance they get. And then we're talking about people like LeBron James, talking about people like Carmelo.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about NBA culture and also the journalistic culture around the NBA where they have a lot more leeway to do this than they do in the NFL.
Well, and I feel like
some of the same, obviously the NBA is a black game. It's played by black athletes. It's covered by black
and
journalists.
And it's identified as sort of a very culturally black sport in a way that the NFL isn't.
Yeah. And this goes back to the whole fact that the way the NFL is very conservative and very sort of temperamentally juvenile in its outward show of patriotism. I feel like Colin Kaepernick really is just kind of following the example of some of the guys who'd be his sports heroes.
I think he certainly is. And, you know, I think the NBA is a much more individualistic game.
Mm-hmm.
We identify individual players in the NBA in a way that we don't in other sports. There's also more individual power in the NBA. Like you,
definitely.
You can't suspend LeBron James or Carmelo Anthony or Chris Paul or Derrick Rose. You know, those are the guys that people come to watch. There aren't that many guys in the NFL that have that kind of power, that they're not replaceable, that they're not.
All of that said, we did just talk about how the NBA like basically torpedoed a guy's career 20
they
years
did.
Ago.
No, they did, 20
but,
years
the,
ago,
but the NBA has the, you know, but you look at last, you know, the last 2 years when guys were showing up on the court for warmups and I Can't Breathe shirts and, you know, Carmelo marched in Baltimore and LeBron with has done it primarily on social media. You even go back to the Donald Sterling fiasco in Los Angeles when guys turned their warmups inside out and threw him on the floor because of the owner making racist comments. And LeBron, you know, across the country saying, hey, man, if these guys want to sit out, I'll be with them.
One of the more grotesque aspects of what Colin Kaepernick has faced is that people say that he shouldn't say what he's saying because he's rich and privileged.
Right, right. Or because he grew up in a white family with white parents.
Yeah. I mean, I have bad news for everybody, but when it comes to talking about poverty and getting things done about poverty, it does take sometimes a couple rich people to stand up and say, I'm going to do the right thing, because we don't listen to poor people
about anything. There's also an important point here when it comes to Colin Kaepernick is that, and the black athlete protesting, is that their status as athletes, their status as wealthy athletes, does not exempt them from the problems that face the black community when it comes to policing. Look at Thabo Sefolosha in New York.
Oh, that's right.
Leg broken by NYPD. Warrick Dunn was pulled over several years ago, the running back, because he looked like somebody transporting drugs or guns. Torrey Hunter was held at gunpoint outside of his home when the alarm went off because police didn't believe it was his. Like, the idea that that athletes are exempt from this because we know who they are.
It's also a perversion of the use of hypocrisy. Right. And somehow somebody's got to be a hypocrite because they're standing up for people who are in some way maybe meaningfully different from them. I do think it's the case that being a wealthy athlete, while you are still subjected to, you know, all sorts of racial problems, that like just being a normal middle class white people, like you're not subjected to. I do think it is a little bit easier to be wealthy and black than to be poor and black. Right. But it's not hypocritical to say this is why we should make things better for all black people.
Right.
You're not. That's not what hypocrisy is.
And I think
is.
There's a powerful element of Colin Kaepernick's protest here in that he's not LeBron. He's not Chris Paul or Dwayne Wade.
Right.
Or, you know, Colin Kaepernick was on the brink of making this roster anyway.
Right.
He might not make the 49ers roster.
And
this is certainly not going to help, you know, even though the 49ers have stood up for him and said he had the right to do this and they respect it, it's certainly not going to help him get a job in the NFL. I mean, if you've seen the anonymous comments executives have made, you know, these people are treating him as one compared him to Ray Carruth, who murdered his pregnant girlfriend.
Right. And
like, the lack of perspective here is crazy. But I think there is an extra power to what Colin Kaepernick did because he was not an untouchable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, there will be many, many people who have committed actual crimes who will be on NFL rosters this year. Well, they didn't diss the flag, so there you go. All right, Travis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it, and we will be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins, and this week we are joined by documentary filmmaker Steve Mims, as well as Huffington Post reporters Paul Blumenthal, Zach Carter, Elise Foley, and Travis Waldron. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Please check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send us an email at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening, and we miss you already.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.